Imagine stepping into a casino, right? You walk up, you put $500,000 on black, and you just watch the little white ball land on red.
Oh man.
Yeah, you are entirely wiped out, just a devastating loss. But now imagine walking out to the parking lot, and the pit boss chases you down,
Right.
and he says, "Hey, tough break, but good news, we're gonna let you write off $3,000 of that against your taxes this year."
Wow, 3,000. How generous.
Right. $3,000 on a $500,000 loss. I mean, it sounds like a joke, but in the eyes of the IRS, that is the exact reality of capital losses.
It really is.
So we are diving into a stack of Series 7 exam study guides, IRS tax code publications, and advisory training manuals today. We're going to master equity tax treatment.
And it is a beast of a
Oh,
topic.
yeah. But before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. Look, if you're studying for the Series 7, they've got this full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams.
Yeah, and they're weighted just like the real thing, which is huge.
Exactly. So check it out at CertFuel.com. Anyway, moving on. The IRS always wants its cut, right? And the Series 7 exam desperately wants to trick you on exactly how they take it.
The U.S. tax code is, well, it's often viewed as this impenetrable fortress of rules.
Yeah, like a giant trap.
Right. And the Series 7 exam tests your ability to navigate those traps hidden inside it. But the secret here to mastering this material, it isn't rote memorization.
Thank goodness, because I can't just memorize flashcards.
Right. It's understanding the underlying mechanics. Every single seemingly arbitrary rule was designed to solve a very specific problem or, close a specific loophole.
Okay, so our mission today is to uncover the why behind the what. And because reading the tax code is frankly a known cure for insomnia, we're going to learn these rules through the suffering of three recurring characters.
I love this approach. Bring them on.
All right, listener, I want you to picture these three people very clearly. First, we have patient Paula.
Okay, patient Paul.
Paula buys quality stocks. She holds them for years, keeps immaculate spreadsheets of all her transactions, and basically her primary goal in life is minimizing her tax burden legally.
She is the IRS's model citizen. I mean,
Yeah.
the tax code is built to reward people exactly like Paul's.
Equally. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, we have careless Carl.
A Carl.
Carl trades on impulse. He buys like meme stocks on his phone while he's waiting in line for coffee. He completely ignores holding periods, and he regularly triggers punitive tax penalties because he just never pays attention to the dates.
A walking cautionary tale, really. He is the person the IRS is actively trying to discourage.
Exactly. And finally, we have generous Grandma Gertrude.
Okay, Grandma Gertrude.
She is an eccentric, wildly wealthy relative. She loves giving away stock to her family while she's alive, and she has this massive, highly appreciated portfolio that is going to cause a really complex inheritance situation when she eventually passes away.
Yeah, Gertrude is going to give us some headaches.
For sure. So keep Paula, Carl, and Gertrude in your mind. We are going to put them through the ringer today.
Let's do it. Let's establish the baseline first. Capital gains, capital losses, and just the fundamental concept of the holding period.
Right, the holding period.
The foundational rule of equity taxation is that the IRS treats your profits differently depending on how long you committed your capital to the market. So whenever you sell a security, they look at the calendar.
And the great dividing line is 1 year, right?
Exactly, 1 year. If you hold a security for 1 year or less, any profit is considered a short-term capital gain.
And short-term gains are punished, relatively speaking. I mean, they are taxed at your ordinary income tax rate.
Right.
So if you're a high earner, that profit is getting taxed just like the salary from your day job, which can be up to 37% at the federal level.
Which eats into your returns significantly.
It really does.
But if you cross that dividing line and you hold the asset for more than 1 year, the IRS rewards you. It becomes a long-term capital gain.
Right, because the government wants to incentivize long-term investment in American businesses. So they offer these preferential tax rates like 0%, 15%, or 20%, depending on your overall income.
Yeah, and for anyone taking the Series 7, unless a test question specifically gives you a different tax bracket, you should just always default to the 15% rate for long-term capital gains.
Good tip. Okay, listener, I want you to think fast. I'm going to give you a scenario.
Let's hear it.
Careless Carl buys the stock on January 1st of this year. He holds it, he gets bored, and he sells it on January 1st of the very next year.
Classic, Carl.
Right. Is that a short-term or long-term gain? Listener, take a second. Think about the exact dates.
This is one of the oldest tricks in the book.
It is. Okay, the answer. January 1st to January 1st is exactly 1 year. It is 365 days.
And the rule for long-term capital gains is strictly more than 1 year.
Which means a minimum of 366 days. So if Carl sells on January 1st, he hits exactly 1 year, which keeps him in the short-term bucket.
Yeah, he pays the 37% ordinary rate.
It's painful. If he had just waited until January 2nd, literally one single day later, he would have secured the 15% rate.
The precision of the dates is critical. I mean, you must pass the 1 year anniversary. So that covers gains. But what happens when things go wrong? Let's talk about capital losses.
Right, because Carl is definitely losing money. So let's say he has a terrible year and loses $50,000 in the market. How does the IRS handle that?
The primary rule is that capital losses offset capital gains dollar for dollar.
Okay.
And there is absolutely no limit to this offsetting capability.
Right, really? No limit?
No limit. If Carl made $100,000 on one brilliant trade and lost $100,000 on a terrible trade, the two completely cancel each other out. His net capital gain is zero. He owes no tax on those transactions.
Wow, okay, that makes perfect sense, actually. The IRS looks at your total net performance. But what if there are no gains to offset? What if Carl just lost $50,000 flat out?
Ah, this brings us back to that casino analogy you opened with.
Yes, the brutal casino.
If your total capital losses exceed your total capital gains for the year, the IRS allows you to take those excess losses and deduct them against your ordinary income.
Meaning your regular salary.
Exactly.
Yeah.
However, they place a strict cap on this. You can only deduct a maximum of $3,000 per year against ordinary income.
Okay, I have always wondered about the logic here. Because why cap it at $3,000? If I legitimately lost $50,000, why can't I write off $50,000 from my income?
It comes down to preventing massive tax evasion by ultra-wealthy individuals.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, imagine a CEO who makes a $5 million cash salary. If there were no limit on ordinary income deductions, that CEO could purposefully sell a failing stock position for a $5 million loss.
And that would completely wipe out the tax liability on their salary.
Exactly. They would pay zero income tax. So the IRS instituted the $3,000 limit to build a firewall between your investment activities and your W-2 wages. You just can't use Wall Street losses to shelter your day job salary.
A firewall. That is a great way to visualize it. But I mean, it feels incredibly unfair to Carl. He has $50,000 in net losses. He uses $3,000 to lower his ordinary income tax. And he still has $47,000 in losses just sitting there. Does that money just vanish?
Not at all. The IRS isn't entirely heartless.
Just mostly.
Right. Any net capital loss that exceeds that $3,000 limit is carried forward to the next tax year. It becomes a carry forward loss.
Oh, okay.
And this carry forward lasts indefinitely. It never expires as long as you are alive.
Okay, so next year, Carl starts January 1st with a $47,000 loss already on his ledger.
Yes.
And if he makes gains, he can use that $47,000 to offset them without limit. If he has no gains next year, he can deduct another $3,000 against his salary, bringing the carry forward down to $44,000. He basically just chips away at it year after year.
Precisely. The losses hold their value, but you are just restricted in how fast you can use them against non-investment income.
Which naturally leads us to the next massive problem.
What's that?
Well, Careless Carl doesn't just make one trade a year. He makes hundreds. He has short-term gains, short-term losses, long-term gains, long-term losses, all happening simultaneously. How on earth does the IRS tally up the final score? It can't just be one giant pile of math.
No, it's not. It is a highly structured four-step netting process.
Netting process, okay.
Yeah, think of it as a tournament bracket. You don't just throw everyone in the ring at once. You have semifinals before you get to the main event.
I was going
to
call it a financial cage match, but a tournament bracket works too. Walk me through the semifinals.
Step one, you separate the holding periods. You take all of your short-term transactions for the year and net them against each other.
So short-term gains minus short-term losses.
Exactly. This gives you a single net short-term result. Step two, you do the exact same thing on the long-term side. Long-term gains minus long-term losses. This gives you a single net long-term result.
Okay, so you keep them in their respective weight classes first. Short-term fights, short-term. Long-term fights, long-term.
Correct. Now you arrive at step three. You look at the two remaining numbers. Let's say after the semifinals, Carl has a net short-term gain of $10,000 and a net long-term gain of $5,000.
So they're both positive numbers.
Because they're both gains, the tournament stops. They do not fight each other. They stay separated.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Carl will pay his high ordinary income rate on the $10,000 short-term gain, and he will pay his preferential 15% rate on the $5,000 long-term gain. The IRS just keeps them in their respective tax buckets.
Okay, but what if one is a gain and one is a loss?
That is step four. the final round. If you have a gain in one category and a loss in the other, they are forced to net against each other.
Okay, listener, exam trap alert. This is where the test writers are going to try to catch you.
Absolutely.
I want to walk through this specific scenario. Let's say after steps one and two, Carl has a $5,000 short-term gain. On the other side, he has a $2,000 long-term loss. So a positive $5,000 short-term and a negative $2,000 long-term. They step into the ring.
Let's see who wins.
The math is easy, right? $5,000 minus $2,000 leaves us with a net positive $3,000. Carl made $3,000 overall.
Right.
But here's the trick question. What is the character of that surviving $3,000? Is it taxed as a short-term gain or a long-term gain?
The rule here is elegant in its simplicity, but it's incredibly easy to forget under exam pressure.
So what is it?
The character of the surviving amount always follows the physically larger original amount.
The heavyweight wins the belt.
Exactly. Look at the two numbers that entered the final round. You have $5,000 short-term and $2,000 long-term.
Right.
The number 5,000 is larger than 2,000. Therefore, the surviving $3,000 adopts the character of the larger number. It is a net short-term capital gain.
Wow. Okay. So even though the long-term loss dragged the total profit down, the short-term side was the dominant force in the equation, so it dictates the final tax treatment.
That's it.
Let me test this to make sure I really get it. Let's reverse it.
Right.
Say Carl has a $10,000 long-term gain and a $12,000 short-term loss.
Run the math.
Okay. $10,000 positive minus $12,000 negative gives a net loss of $2,000.
Right.
The larger original number was the $12,000, which was short-term. So the surviving $2,000 is a net short-term capital loss.
Perfect. Character always follows the larger absolute value.
Now, to even enter this tournament bracket, the IRS needs to know your starting weight. You cannot calculate a gain or a loss without knowing exactly what you paid for the asset in the first place.
Right, which brings us to the surprisingly complex world of cost basis.
Ah, cost basis.
So basis is the absolute foundation of all equity tax math. I mean, if your basis is wrong, your entire tax return is wrong.
That makes sense.
At its simplest, your cost basis is the original purchase price of the security, but it also includes the cost required to acquire that security.
You're talking about commissions and fees. So the formula for cost basis is the purchase price of the stock plus any commission paid to the broker.
Right.
And on the back end, when you sell, your net proceeds are the sale price minus any commission paid to execute the trade.
That is the formula.
And I have to push back on this because it always feels backwards to me.
Why is that?
Well, I am paying extra money in fees to buy the stock, and I am receiving less money when I sell it because the broker takes a cut. How is this a benefit for my taxes?
Ah, this is a classic example of a rule that favors the taxpayer.
Okay, I like the sound of that.
Let's break down the mechanics of a taxable gain.
Yeah.
A gain is simply your net proceeds minus your cost basis. If the IRS allows you to add the commission to your purchase price, your official cost basis goes up. It is artificially inflated by the fee.
Okay, so if I buy a stock for $100 and pay a $5 commission, my cost basis isn't $100, it's $105.
Right. Now, let's say you sell it later for $200 and you pay another $5 commission. The IRS allows you to subtract that fee from the sale price. Your net proceeds are not $200, they are $195.
Oh, I see the math now. Instead of calculating my profit as $200 minus $100, which would be a $100 taxable gain,
right.
I calculate it as $195 minus $100. My taxable gain is only $90.
Exactly. The higher cost basis and the lower net proceeds squeeze your profit margin on paper. The IRS is essentially allowing you to deduct the broker's fees directly out of your taxable profit. It shields a portion of your gains from taxation.
The IRS letting me use a fee as a shield. I love that.
It's rare, but it happens.
But that is just a single trade. Let's bring patient Paula into this. Paula doesn't just buy a stock once, she dollar cost averages.
Oh, she's organized.
Very. Let's say she buys shares of XYZ tech stock three times this year. She buys a batch in January at $30 a share. The stock goes up, so she buys another batch in April at $40 a share. It goes up again, and she buys a final batch in July at $50 a share.
Okay, so three different lots.
Right. Then in November, she decides to sell just one batch of her shares. Which price tag is her cost basis? The 30, the 40, or the 50?
This depends entirely on whether Paula communicates with her broker.
Interesting.
If Paula simply hits sell on her brokerage app and doesn't provide any specific instructions, the IRS defaults to a method called FIFO, first in, first out.
Exam trap alert. Listener, if you are reading a question about a multi-lot sale and the prompt does not explicitly state which accounting method the investor chose, you must scream FIFO in your head. First in, first out is always the default.
Always. And in Paula's case, first in means the very first shares she bought, the oldest shares. That would be the January batch she purchased at $30.
But wait, look at the market environment in this scenario. The stock went from 30 to 40 to 50. It's a rising market.
Yeah.
If she sells the $30 shares first, she has the lowest possible cost basis.
Right.
Which creates the largest possible gap between her purchase price and her current sale price.
Which results in the highest possible tax bill. Using FIFO in a rising market maximizes your capital gains.
But Paula despises high taxes. She tracks everything on a spreadsheet. She wants to sell the shares she bought for $50, so her profit on paper looks tiny.
Mm.
Can she use LIFO? Last in, first out.
Investors can choose LIFO, which would indeed sell the newest, most expensive shares first and minimize the current tax hit. However, the most flexible and commonly tested alternative to FIFO is specific identification.
Specific ID. This is where Paula calls her broker and says, I am selling 100 shares of XYZ, and I want you to specifically sell the tax lot I purchased on July 14th for $50 a share.
Exactly. She is identifying the specific shares to optimize her tax outcome.
Brilliant.
But there is a massive procedural trap here. She must identify those specific shares no later than the settlement date of the trade.
Timing is everything.
If she executes the trade on Monday and waits until Thursday to tell the broker she wanted to use the July shares, she is too late. The default FIFO rule takes over, and she is stuck selling the $30 shares.
The paperwork must match the trade by settlement date. Understood. Okay, time for a pattern interrupt.
Here we go.
Hey, listener, wake up, shake out your arms, roll your neck, take a breath. This next section is universally tested. I guarantee you will see this concept on your exam.
You definitely will.
Pay attention, because generous Grandma Gertrude is entering the story.
We are transitioning from buying stock to receiving stock.
Mm-hmm.
And the IRS draws a massive fundamental distinction between receiving stock because someone passed away, an inheritance, versus receiving stock as a gift while the person is still alive. The tax outcomes are polar opposites.
Let's start with the morbid but lucrative option. Gertrude passes away and leaves her massive portfolio to patient Paula.
Rest in peace, Gertrude.
Yes, RIP. Let's say Gertrude bought a blue chip stock decades ago for $10 a share. On the day she dies, that stock is trading at $100 a share. She had $90 of unrealized profit per share. What happens to that profit when Paula inherits the account?
Paula benefits from one of the most powerful provisions of the tax code, the stepped-up basis.
Stepped-up basis, okay.
When you inherit a security, your cost basis is instantly stepped up to the fair market value of the asset on the date of the original owner's death. So Paula's new official cost basis is $100.
Wait, what about the $90 of profit Gertrude accumulated over all those years?
It is entirely forgiven. The IRS just deletes it from existence.
You're kidding.
Nope. If Paula sells that stock the very next day for $100, her proceeds are $100, her stepped-up basis is $100, and she reports exactly zero capital gains.
Death equals delete the game. That is staggering. Why would the IRS just willingly give up all that tax revenue? They never do that.
It's about preventing double taxation, and it's also about administrative reality.
How so?
Well, historically, large estates are subject to the estate tax, which takes a massive percentage of the total asset value. The government felt it was unfair to tax the estate on the total value and then immediately hit the heir with a capital gains tax on the exact same assets.
Double dipping. Okay, that makes sense.
Secondly, imagine the administrative nightmare. If you inherit a stock certificate your grandmother bought in 1974, how on earth are you supposed to find the original purchase receipt to prove the cost basis?
You wouldn't be able to. It's lost in a shoebox somewhere.
Right, so the step-up rule eliminates that impossible paperwork burden.
That actually makes total sense. Now let's talk about the holding period for inherited stock, because Paula sold it the very next day. Is that a short-term trade?
This is a recurring exam trap. Inherited securities are always considered long-term. Always.
Always.
Always. It does not matter if Gertrude bought the stock on a Tuesday, died on Wednesday, and Paula inherited and sold it on Thursday. The IRS automatically classifies inherited property as long-term.
Giving her those sweet lower tax rates.
Exactly. Granting the heir the preferential tax rates on any future gains above that stepped-up basis.
Direct question to the listener. Say it with me out loud. Inherited stock is always long-term. Lock that in.
Good to drill that in.
Now, what about this alternate valuation date concept? I see that in the study materials.
Right. In some cases, the executor of an estate might look at the portfolio and realize the stock market crashed right after Gertrude died. Yeah, so the stock was $100 on the date of death. But 6 months later, it's only worth $70. The IRS allows the executor to choose an alternate valuation date, which is exactly 6 months after the date of death.
So they can step up, or in this case, step down, the basis to the $70 mark. Why would they do that? That seems bad.
They can only elect to do this if using the lower valuation actually reduces the gross value of the estate, thereby lowering the estate taxes owed. It is a relief mechanism for estates trapped in a plunging market.
Ah, I see. But what if the stock goes up to $120 after 6 months?
You cannot use the alternate date to get a higher step up. It is only permitted if it lowers the estate tax burden.
Okay, so inheritance gives you a stepped-up basis to fair market value, and it's always long-term. But what if Gertrude doesn't pass away? What if she's alive and well and just decides to gift Paula the stock for her birthday?
The rules flip completely.
Of course they do.
A gift from a living person usually triggers a carryover basis. Mm. If Gertrude bought the stock for $10 and gifts it to Paula when it's worth $100, Paula does not get a step up.
No step up.
No. She carries over or inherits Gertrude's original $10 cost basis.
So gift equals grandfather the basis. The IRS is not deleting that $90 gain. They're just passing the buck to Paula.
Yes. When Paula eventually sells, she will owe the taxes on Gertrude's profit.
Got it. And what about the holding period?
The holding period, tax on.
Tax on.
Gertrude's time holding the asset is added directly to Paula's. If Gertrude held it for 10 years, Paula receives it as a long-term asset on day one.
Okay, that seems straightforward enough. But earlier, you emphasized the word usually. What is the trap here?
The trap is called the dual basis rule, and it is triggered specifically when someone gifts a security that has lost value. It's known as a depreciated gift.
Oh, boy.
Let's say Gertrude bought a stock for $80. The company struggles. And on the day she gifts the stock to Paula, the fair market value has plummeted to $50.
Gertrude gives terrible birthday presents.
She really does. Now, under normal carryover rules, Paula would inherit the $80 basis. If Paula immediately sold the stock for $50, she would generate a $30 capital loss, which she could use to offset her own taxes.
Which sounds like a great loophole. Gertrude has a loss she doesn't need, so she gifts the loss to Paula to lower Paula's tax bill.
Exactly. And the IRS saw that loophole a mile away. They absolutely refused to let taxpayers transfer their investment losses to other people.
Buzzkills.
To prevent this, they created the dual basis rule. When you receive a depreciated gift, the IRS attaches two different price tags to the stock. The donor's original basis, which is $80, and the fair market value on the date of the gift, which is $50.
Okay, listeners, stop whatever you are doing. If you are walking the dog, stop, look at a tree, and think through this logic.
That's tricky.
Paula has a stock with two basis numbers, $80 and $50. She decides to sell the stock immediately for $40. Does she get to claim a $40 loss by subtracting her $40 sale price from Gertrude's original $80 purchase price?
Take a second.
Think about the loophole the expert just described.
The answer is no. When calculating a loss in a depreciated gift, you are forced to use the lower fair market value on the date of the gift as your basis.
So Paula's basis for a loss is $50.
Right.
So when she sells at $40, she only gets to claim a $10 loss on her tax return. The other $30 of loss that Gertrude experienced just evaporates. The IRS won't let Paula claim it.
Correct. The loss is strictly limited to what happened after Paula took ownership.
Wow.
And importantly, because she is using the gift date value, the holding period does not tack on.
Wait, really?
Yeah. For that $10 loss, her holding period clock started fresh on the day she received the gift.
Okay, let's look at the other side. What if the stock rebounds? Gertrude bought at $80, gifted at $50, but a year later, the stock rockets up to $100. Paula sells. Which basis does she use for a gain?
For a gain, you revert to the standard carryover rule. You use the donor's original $80 basis.
So Paula's taxable gain is $20, and because she used the original basis, the holding period does tack on.
You've got it.
So use the $50 basis to calculate a loss. Use the $80 basis to calculate a gain. But there is a mathematical gap here. What if she sells the stock for $60? That price is higher than the $50 gift date value, but lower than Gertrude's original $80 purchase price.
You've entered no man's land.
No man's land.
If the sale price falls between the donor's original basis and the fair market value on the date of the gift, there is zero taxable gain and zero deductible loss. Neither price tag applies. It is a completely non-taxable event.
No man's land equals zero tax. I guarantee that will be a Roman numeral question on the exam.
It almost certainly will be.
All right, let's pivot to corporate actions. Up to this point, we've been tracking basis based on how we acquired the stock. But what if the corporation itself steps in and alters the math while we are holding it, like a stock split or a stock dividend?
This happens all the time.
Right. Let's say I own 100 shares of a stock. The company declares a 10% stock dividend. They just deposit 10 brand new shares into my account. I have more property than I did yesterday. I made free money. Right.
This is a massive misconception, and the exam absolutely preys on it. A stock dividend, or a forward stock split, is absolutely not a taxable event. It is not income.
But I literally have more shares. How is that not income?
Because your underlying economic value hasn't changed. Think of the company's total value as a pizza.
Okay, I like pizza.
You own one slice of an 8-slice pizza. The company just came along with a cutter and sliced your piece in half.
So now I have 2 slices.
You now have 2 slices, but the total amount of pizza you own is exactly the same. Your overall ownership percentage of the company hasn't increased.
Okay, so if the total value is the same, what happens to my cost basis?
Your total cost basis stays exactly the same. It just gets spread out over a larger number of shares, which lowers your per share cost basis.
Let's do the math on that. Say I originally invested $5,000 to buy 100 shares. My cost basis is $50 a share.
Right.
The company gives me a 10% stock dividend. So I receive 10 new shares. I now have 110 shares. But my total investment is still locked at $5,000. So I divide $5,000 by 110 shares. My new per-share basis drops to roughly $45 or 45 cents.
Exactly. You adjust the per-share math, but you owe no taxes until you actually sell the shares. And you must be careful on the exam. They will sometimes test a reverse split.
A reverse split?
Yeah. If a company does a 1-for-5 reverse split, you end up with fewer shares, which means your per-share cost basis will increase significantly because the total investment is squeezed into a smaller number of shares.
Oh, I see. Total basis never changes, just the divisor. What about stock rights? A company issues rights to existing shareholders, giving them the privilege to buy more stock at a discount to the current market price. Are those rights taxed when they hit my account?
This introduces a very specific IRS calculation known as the 15% rule.
The 15% rule, okay.
When you receive stock rights, you must compare the fair market value of the rights themselves to the fair market value of the underlying common stock on the day they are issued.
So I have to do a ratio analysis.
Yes. If the value of the rights is less than 15% of the underlying stock's value, the IRS considers those rights to be relatively insignificant. By default, they assign the rights a cost basis of zero.
Zero.
You do have the option to voluntarily allocate a portion of your original stock's cost basis to the rights, but if you make that election, it is permanent and irrevocable.
And if the rights are highly valuable, say they are worth 20% of the stock's value.
If the rights are valued at 15% or more of the stock's value, the IRS removes your choice. Allocation becomes mandatory. You must perform the math and shift a proportional amount of your original cost basis away from your stock and assign it to the new rights.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, why did the IRS pick 15%? It seems so arbitrary.
It is entirely about administrative efficiency.
Again, with the paperwork.
Exactly. The IRS knows that most stock rights are issued at values well under 15%. They do not want to force millions of retail investors to perform complex fractional math on their tax returns to track a few pennies a basis. The paperwork burden would completely outweigh the tax revenue.
Right.
But if a company is issuing massively valuable rights, like 15% or higher, the IRS demands the tracking be done so that large capital gains aren't hidden by zero basis accounting.
The IRS weighing the cost of paperwork against the revenue. Fascinating. But here's a scenario I want to throw at you.
Go for it.
Say, Careless Carl receives rights. Because they are valuable, he is forced to allocate $500 of his cost basis to them. But because he's Carl, he gets distracted, forgets the expiration date, and the rights simply expire worthless in his account.
Oh, Carl.
Does he get to claim a $500 capital loss for the expired rights?
No, he does not. If stock rights expire unexercised, you do not get a tax deduction.
What happens to the basis?
The IRS says that the $500 of basis you allocated simply flows right back to your original common stock shares. The basis goes home.
No tax loss for you, Carl. Now, speaking of exercising rights, let's explore how different corporate actions affect the holding period clock. I call this holding period metamorphosis, conversions versus exercises.
I like that title. This is all about the concept of tacking, which we discussed with gifts. The IRS treats a conversion fundamentally differently than an exercise.
How so?
Let's look at a convertible corporate bond. If you own a bond that can be converted into common stock, and you choose to convert it, the IRS does not view that as a taxable event.
Why not? I am trading a debt instrument for an equity instrument. I mean, I have a completely different security in my account.
Because the IRS views it as a change in form, not a new economic investment. You aren't putting fresh capital into the market. You are just utilizing a feature embedded in the original security you bought. It's an exchange, not a new purchase.
Okay, so you traded your blue shirt for a red shirt, but you still own a shirt.
Precisely. And because it's not a new purchase, the holding period tax on.
Tax on, right.
If you held that convertible bond for 14 months before you converted it, your brand new shares of common stock instantly inherit that 14-month history. They're immediately classified as long-term.
Direct question for the listener. Pay attention to the logic the expert just laid out regarding fresh capital.
It's the key.
If converting a bond tax on, what happens when I exercise a stock right? Does the time I held the right tack on to the new stock? Think about the mechanics of exercising.
Think about that fresh capital.
The answer is an emphatic no. Exercising a stock right requires you to hand over fresh cash to the company to buy brand new shares. You are committing new capital.
Because of that, the IRS views it as a brand new purchase, which starts a brand new holding period clock.
The fresh cash creates a new timeline. And when exactly does that new clock start ticking?
It starts on the exact date you exercise the right.
On the date.
This is highly testable because it is a rare exception to the normal rule. If you buy a stock normally on the open market, your holding period begins the day after the trade date. But when you exercise a right, the clock starts on the date of exercise.
Write that down. Converting equals tacking. Exercising equals a brand new clock starting on the exercise date. Let's look at one more weird holding period, when issued securities.
When issued, or WI securities, are securities that have been authorized and are trading on the market, but the fiscal certificates or final issuance hasn't formally settled yet. They are trading on a when, as, and if issued basis.
It's like buying a new construction house before it's built, right? You sign the contract, you lock in the purchase price, but there is no physical house for you to live in yet.
That's a perfect analogy. And the question for taxes is, when does your holding period start? Does it start when you sign the contract or when the house is finally built months later?
When does it start?
For when issued securities, the IRS looks at when you committed your capital and took on market risk. Therefore, the holding period begins the day after the when issued trade date.
It does not wait for the eventual settlement date, because if the market crashes the day after you sign the contract, you are the one losing money.
Right.
You took the risk, so the clock starts.
Exactly. You are on the hook, so the IRS starts counting your time.
Okay, let's shift gears. We've bought the stock, we've held the stock, we've navigated splits and rights, but while patient Paula is holding her blue chip stocks, the companies are sending her cash. Dividend distributions.
Everyone loves dividends.
How does the IRS view that cash hitting her account?
Dividends are taxed, but the rate depends entirely on whether the dividend is classified as qualified or non-qualified. Qualified dividends are the holy grail of income investing.
Why is that?
They receive the exact same preferential tax rates as long-term capital gains, so 0%, 15%, or 20%.
Which means 15% for our exam purposes. That is a massive savings compared to a 37% ordinary income rate. So how does Paula ensure her dividends are designated as qualified?
It all comes down to a specific holding period test. The IRS wants to ensure you are a legitimate long-term investor in the company, not a day trader just trying to capture a quick dividend payout.
Right.
To get the qualified rate, Paula must hold the stock for more than 60 days during a specific 121-day window.
Stop right there. 121-day window. Let's break that down because the math is weird. What is the center point of that window?
The center point is the ex-dividend date.
And for anyone fuzzy on that term, the ex-dividend date is the first day the stock trades without the value of the dividend attached. If you buy the stock on the ex-dividend date, you are too late. You will not receive the upcoming dividend. You have to buy it before that date.
Exactly. So the 121-day window consists of the 60 days before the ex-dividend date, the ex-dividend date itself, and the 60 days after the ex-dividend date. 60 plus 1 plus 60 equals 121 days.
Okay.
Paula must hold the stock for more than 60 days somewhere inside that window. If she holds it for 60 days or fewer, the dividend is non-qualified, and she gets slammed with her high ordinary income tax rate.
The IRS is punishing dividend capture strategies. They don't want Careless Carl buying a stock on Monday, collecting a massive dividend on Tuesday, selling the stock on Wednesday, and claiming a 15% tax rate.
Precisely. It forces commitment. Now, there are certain types of investments where the dividends are almost never qualified, regardless of how long you hold them.
Like what?
Real estate investment trusts, or REITs, and money market funds generally distribute non-qualified dividends.
Taxed as ordinary income.
Correct. And if you are shorting a stock, any dividend you have to pay out is not qualified.
Okay, here comes a major exam trap regarding distributions. The expert is going to stress this heavily, so listen up. What happens if a company announces a distribution, but they specifically classify it as a return of capital?
This is a critical distinction in tax law. A traditional taxable dividend is paid out of a company's accumulated earnings and profits. They made money, so they share the profits with you.
Right.
But a return of capital is a distribution that is paid in excess of their earnings and profits.
Wait, if they didn't make enough profit to cover the check they just sent me, whose money is it?
It's your money. They are quite literally handing you back a portion of your original investment principal. Because it is simply a return of your own money, the IRS does not consider a return of capital to be taxable income in the year you receive it. You owe zero taxes on it today.
So what is the catch? The IRS never gives a free lunch.
Never. The catch is that it reduces your cost basis. If you originally bought 100 shares at $50 a share, and the company issues a $5 per share return of capital, you put that $500 cash in your pocket tax-free.
Okay.
But you must adjust your basis down. Your new cost basis for those shares is $45.
Which means when I eventually sell the stock years later, the gap between my basis and my sale price will be larger, and I will pay higher capital gains taxes then.
Exactly. A return of capital didn't eliminate the tax. It defers it by lowering your basis.
Highly testable concept right there. Return of capital equals lower cost basis, not immediate taxable income. All right, we have arrived at the final boss of equity taxation, the ultimate penalty, the black hole of tax law.
Oh, boy.
Careless Carl's worst nightmare, the wash sale rule.
This rule is responsible for more tax season tears than perhaps any other regulation.
Let's set the scene with Carl. It's mid-December. Carl bought XYZ stock earlier in the year for $5,000. It has been a disaster and is currently trading at $3,000.
Ouch.
Carl is a high earner, so he decides to do some tax loss harvesting. On a Monday, he sells the stock, locking in a $2,000 capital loss to offset some other gains he made. He feels like a genius. But on Thursday, XYZ announces a massive new product.
And no.
Carl panics, realizing he misses the stock, and buys the exact same shares right back.
Carl just triggered the wash sale rule.
He did.
The IRS explicitly states that if you sell a security at a loss and you purchase a substantially identical security within a restricted time window, that tax loss is entirely disallowed. You cannot claim it on your tax return for that year.
The IRS just cancels the deduction. What exactly is this restricted time window? Because the common wisdom on the street is you have to wait 30 days.
The street is only half right. The wash sale window is actually 61 days long.
61 days?
Yes. It encompasses the 30 days before the sale, the day of the sale itself, or the 30 days after the sale.
30 days before? How can you trigger a wash sale before you even sell it?
By doubling up. If Carl bought his original shares in January, but then bought a second batch of shares on December 1st, and then sold the January shares at a loss on December 15th.
Oh.
Yeah, that December 1st purchase falls inside the 30-day before window. The loss is disallowed.
That is brutal. Why is the IRS so aggressive about this 61-day window?
Historically, before this rule existed, wealthy investors would hold massive portfolios with embedded losses.
Right.
In late December, they would sell all their losers to harvest the tax write-offs and then immediately buy them all back the very next day. They maintained their exact same economic position in the market, but generated massive phantom losses on paper to wipe out their tax bills.
Wow, that's quite a loophole.
So the IRS created the 61-day window to force investors to take real prolonged market risk if they want the tax deduction. If you want the loss, you have to stay out of the stock for a month.
Okay, so Carl knows about the 30-day wait. He sells the stock at a loss on Monday. On Thursday, instead of buying the stock back directly, he gets clever. He goes to the options market and buys a call option on XYZ's stock.
Sneaky Carl.
The option gives him the right to buy the stock later. Does that trigger the wash sale?
Yes, it does. You cannot sneak through the options back door.
No back door.
The IRS defines a call option, a warrant, or a convertible bond of the same company as being substantially identical to the underlying stock. Buying the call option triggers the wash sale, and the loss is disallowed.
What if he sells a tech stock like Apple at a loss and then immediately buys Microsoft?
That is perfectly fine. Buying a different stock, even a direct competitor in the exact same industry, does not trigger the rule. The securities must be substantially identical. Apple and Microsoft are different companies.
Okay, so Carl bought the stock back on Thursday. He triggered the rule. His $2,000 tax deduction is disallowed. Is that money just gone forever? Did he lose it permanently?
No.
Not if he executed these trades in a standard taxable brokerage account. In a normal account, The wash sale rule is a mechanism of deferral, not destruction.
Deferral, how does that work?
The IRS takes that disallowed $2,000 loss, and they force Carl to add it to the cost basis of the new shares he just purchased.
Okay, let's walk through that math. Carl yield for a $2,000 loss. On Thursday, he bought the new shares for $3,000. What is his official cost basis for those new shares?
His basis is the $3,000 purchase price plus the $2,000 disallowed loss. His new cost basis is artificially inflated to $5,000.
Which means the loss is baked into the new position. When he eventually sells those new shares next year, assuming he stays out of the wash sale window, that artificially high $5,000 cost basis will severely reduce his taxable gain, effectively allowing him to finally claim that original loss.
Correct. The tax benefit isn't gone. It's simply delayed until he truly exits the position.
Okay, that's annoying, but it's not a catastrophe. However, you specifically said in a standard taxable brokerage account. What happens if Carl gets really creative? What is the IRA black hole trap?
Oh, this might be the most devastating tax mistake an individual investor can make, and it is heavily tested.
Okay, let's hear it.
The wash sale rule applies across all accounts you control. It doesn't matter if one account is at Fidelity and the other is at Schwab. So imagine Carl sells XYZ stock at a $2,000 loss in his normal taxable brokerage account. He wants that tax write-off.
Right.
But 3 days later, he logs into his traditional IRA, a completely separate tax-advantaged retirement account, and he buys the stock back inside the IRA.
He bought substantially identical securities within the 30-day window. Boom, wash sale triggered. The $2,000 loss in the taxable account is disallowed. But earlier you said the loss gets added to the cost basis of the new shares. How do you adjust the cost basis of a stock inside a pre-tax IRA?
You cannot. This is the black hole. Traditional IRAs do not track individual cost basis for capital gains purposes because everything that comes out of a traditional IRA at retirement is taxed as ordinary income anyway. The IRS strictly forbids adjusting the basis of assets inside an IRA.
Wait, if the loss is disallowed in the taxable account and it legally cannot be attached to the new shares in the IRA, where does the $2,000 tax deduction go?
It ceases to exist. Because there is nowhere to legally attach the deferred loss, the tax deduction is permanently, irrevocably destroyed. Carl loses the $2,000 write-off forever.
It is vaporized. That is terrifying.
It is. The cardinal rule of tax loss harvesting is to never, ever cross-contaminate taxable losses with IRA repurchases. Keep your wash sales out of your IRA.
Wow. We have covered an immense amount of ground, from netting brackets to step-ups to black holes.
A lot of ground.
Let's lock this in with a pattern interrupt. Rapid-fire recap. Listener, see if you can answer these before the expert does. I'm going to throw the concepts out. You give me the absolute must-know takeaway for the exam. Ready?
Let's go.
Inherited stock. What is the holding period and the basis?
Inherited stock is always considered long-term. The cost basis is stepped up to the fair market value on the date of death. Death deletes the gain.
A multi-lot stock sale where the investor doesn't specify which shares to sell.
The default is FIFO. First in, first out. In a rising market, this liquidates the cheapest shares first, resulting in the largest taxable gain.
You convert a corporate bond into common stock. Taxable event. Does the clock reset?
It is not a taxable event. It is a change of form. And the holding period of the bond tax on to the new common stock.
But what if you exercise a stock right?
Exercising requires fresh cash. It starts a brand new holding period clock. And that clock starts on end the date of exercise.
Wash sale window. How many days total and what happens in an IRA?
61 days total. 30 days before, the day of, and 30 days after. If you trigger it by repurchasing inside an IRA, the loss is permanently destroyed.
Love it. All right, before we sign off, leave us with a final provocative thought. How should the listener conceptualize all these disjointed rules when they sit down for the exam?
When you are deep in the weeds of studying, it is easy to view tax law as just a giant calculator, a sterile mechanism for the government to extract revenue. But if you step back and look at the architecture of these rules, the 15% preferential rate for holding over a year, the punitive wash sale penalties for quick trading, the step up in basis that rewards lifetime holding. Tax law isn't just math. It is behavioral engineering.
Behavioral engineering. I like that.
The IRS is actively designing the game board to dictate how you play. They want to force you to hold your investments longer. They want to punish you for trying to game the system with short-term manipulation. And they want to reward patience.
So when you sit for the Series 7.
Right. If you encounter a question where you genuinely don't know the mathematical answer, ask yourself, which multiple choice option rewards long-term capital commitment and punishes short-term trickery? That philosophical North Star will often guide you to the correct answer.
The tax code as behavioral engineering? Patient Paula plays the game the way the IRS wants, so she wins. Careless Carl tries to cheat the system, so he pays the toll. Listener, if you understand the why behind the rules, you won't just memorize the tax questions, you will dominate them. Go crush the Series 7, check out CertFuel.com for incredible practice exams, and we will see you on the next deep dive.